Chapter 5. It had been a shock, meeting Selvar face to face. As he flew back to Central from the foothill village, Lyubov tried to decide why it had been a shock, to analyze out the nerve that had jumped. For after all, one isn't usually terrified by a chance meeting with a good friend. It hadn't been easy to get the head woman to invite him. Tuntar had been his main locus of study all summer. He had several excellent informants there, and was on good terms with the lodge and with the headwoman, who had let him observe and participate in the community freely. Wangling an actual invitation out of her, via some of the ex-serfs still in the area, had taken a long time, but at last she had complied, giving him, according to the new directives, a genuine occasion arranged by the Athshians. His own conscience, rather than the colonel, had insisted on this. Dunna wanted him to go. He was worried about the Creechy threat. He told Lyubov to size them up, to see how they're reacting now that we're leaving them strictly alone. He hoped for reassurance. Lyubov couldn't decide whether the report he'd been turning in would reassure Colonel Dunna or not. For 10 miles out of Central, the plain had been logged, and the stumps had all rotted away. It was now a great, dull flat of fiberweed, hairy gray in the rain. Under those hirsute leaves, the seedling shrubs got their first growth, the sumacs, dwarf aspens, the salviforms, which, grown, would in turn protect the seedling trees. Left alone in this even, rainy climate, this area might reforest itself within 30 years and reattain the full climax forest within 100. Left alone. Suddenly, the forest began again, in space, not time. Under the helicopter, the infinitely various green of leaves covered the slow swells and folding of the hills of North Sornal. Like most Terrans on Terra, Lyubov had never walked among wild trees at all, never seen a wood larger than a city block. At first, on Athshi, he had felt oppressed and uneasy in the forest, stifled by its endless crowd and incoherence of trunks, branches, leaves in the perpetual greenish or brownish twilight. The mass and jumble of various competitive lives all pushing and swelling outwards and upwards towards light. The silence made up of many little meaningless noises. The total, vegetable indifference to the presence of mind. All this had troubled him, and like the others, he had kept to clearings and to the beach. But little by little, he had begun to like it. Gossa teased him, calling him Mr. Gibbon. In fact, Lyubov looked rather like a gibbon, with a round, dark face, long arms and hair graying early. But gibbons were extinct. Like it or not, as a hilfer, he had to go into the forests to find the hilfs. And now, after 4 years of it, he was completely at home under the trees. More so, perhaps, than anywhere else. He had also come to like the Athshians' names for their own lands and places. Sonorous, two-syllabled words. Sornal, Tuntar, Eshreth, Eshson. That was now Centralville. Entor, Abtan, and above all, Athshi, which meant the forest and the world. So Earth, Terra, Telus, meant both the soil and the planet, two meanings and one. But to the Athshians, soil, ground, earth, was not that to which the dead return and by which the living live. The substance of their world was not earth, but forest. Terran man was clay, red dust. Athshian man was branch and root. They did not carve figures of themselves in stone, only in wood. He brought the hopper down in a small glade north of the town and walked in past the women's lodge. The smell of an Athshean settlement hung pungent in the air. Wood smoke, dead fish, aromatic herbs, alien sweat. The atmosphere of an underground house, if a Terran could fit himself in at all, was a rare compound of CO2 and stinks. Lyubov had spent many intellectually stimulating hours doubled up and suffocating in the reeking gloom of the men's lodge in Tuntar. But it didn't look as if he would be invited in this time. Of course, the townsfolk knew of the Smith Camp massacre, now 6 weeks ago. They would have known of it soon, for word got around fast among the islands, though not so fast as to constitute a mysterious power of telepathy, as the loggers like to believe. The townsfolk also knew that the 1,200 slaves at Centralville had been freed soon after the Smith Camp massacre, and Lyubov agreed with the colonel that the natives might take the second event to be the result of the first. That gave what Colonel Dunna would call an erroneous impression, but it probably wasn't important. What was important was that the slaves had been freed. Wrongs done could not be righted, but at least they were not still being done. They could start over. The natives, without that painful, unanswerable wonder as to why the humans treated men like animals. And he, without the burden of explanation and the gnawing of irremediable guilt. Knowing how they valued candor and direct speech concerning frightening or troublous matters, he expected that people in Tuntar would talk about these things with him, in triumph or apology, or rejoicing or puzzlement. No one did. No one said much of anything to him. He had come in late afternoon, which was like arriving in a Terran city just after dawn. Athshians did sleep. The colonists' opinion, as often, ignored observable fact. But their physiological low was between noon and 4 p.m., whereas with Terrans, it is usually between 2 and 5 a.m., and they had a double peak cycle of high temperature and high activity, coming in the two twilights, dawn and evening. Most adults slept 5 or 6 hours in 24, in several catnaps. And adept men slept as little as 2 hours in 24, so if one discounted both their naps and their dreaming states as laziness, one might say they never slept. It was much easier to say that than to understand what they actually did do. At this point in Tuntar, things were just beginning to stir again after the late-day slump. Lyubov noticed a good many strangers. They looked at him, but none approached. They were mere presences passing on other paths in the dusk of the great oaks. At last, someone he knew came along his path, the head woman's cousin, Sharar. An old woman of small importance and small understanding. She greeted him civilly, but did not or would not respond to his inquiries about the headwoman and his two best informants, Agath, the orchard keeper, and Tubab, the dreamer. Oh, the headwoman was very busy. And who was Agath? Did he mean Gaben? And Tubab might be here, or perhaps he was there, or not. She stuck to Lyubov, and nobody else spoke to him. He worked his way, accompanied by the hobbling, complaining, tiny green crone, across the groves and glades of Tuntar to the men's lodge.
"They're busy in there," said Sharar.
"Dreaming?"
"However should I know? Come along now, Lyubov. Come see."
She knew he always wanted to see things, but she couldn't think what to show him to draw him away.
"Come see the fishing nets," she said feebly.
A girl passing by, one of the young hunters, looked up at him. A black look. A stare of animosity such as he had never received from any Athshean, unless, perhaps, from a little child, frightened into scowling by his height and his hairless face. But this girl was not frightened. All right, he said to Sharar, feeling that his only course was docility. If the Athshians had indeed developed, at last and abruptly, the sense of group enmity, then he must accept this, and simply try to show them that he remained a reliable, unchanging friend. But how could their way of feeling and thinking have changed so fast, after so long? And why? At Smith Camp, provocation had been immediate and intolerable. Davidson's cruelty would drive even Athshians to violence. But this town, Tuntar, had never been attacked by the Terrans, had suffered no slave raids, had not seen the local forest logged or burned. He, Lyubov himself, had been there. The anthropologist cannot always leave his own shadow out of the picture he draws, but not for over 2 months now. They had got the news from Smith, and there were among them now refugees, ex-slaves who had suffered at the Terran's hands and would talk about it. But would news and hearsay change the hearers, change them radically, when their unaggressiveness ran so deep in them, right through their culture and society, and on down into their subconscious, their dream time, and perhaps into their very physiology? That an Athshian could be provoked by atrocious cruelty to attempt murder, he knew. He had seen it happen once. That a disrupted community might be similarly provoked by similarly intolerable injuries, he had to believe. It had happened at Smith Camp. But that talk and hearsay, no matter how frightening and outrageous, could enrage a settled community of these people to the point where they acted against their customs and reason, broke entirely out of their whole style of living, this he couldn't believe. It was psychologically improbable. Some element was missing. Old Tubab came out of the lodge just as Lyubov passed in front of it. Behind the old man came Selver. Selver crawled out of the tunnel door, stood upright, blinked at the rain-grayed, foliage-dimmed brightness of daylight. His dark eyes met Lyubov's, looking up. Neither spoke. Lyubov was badly frightened. Flying home in the hopper, analyzing out the shocked nerve, he thought, why fear? Why was I afraid of Selver? Unprovable intuition or mere false analogy? Irrational, in any case. Nothing between Selver and Lyubov had changed. What Selver had done at Smith Camp could be justified. Even if it couldn't be justified, it made no difference. The friendship between them was too deep to be touched by moral doubt. They had worked very hard together. They had taught each other, in rather more than the literal sense, their languages. They had spoken without reserve. And Lyubov's love for his friend was deepened by that gratitude the Savior feels toward the one whose life he has been privileged to save. Indeed, he had scarcely realized until that moment how deep his liking and loyalty to Selver were. Had his fear, in fact, been the personal fear that Selver might, having learned racial hatred, reject him, despise his loyalty, and treat him not as you, but as one of them? After that long first gaze, Selver came forward slowly and greeted Lyubov, holding out his hands. Touch was a main channel of communication among the forest people. Among Terrans, touch is always likely to imply threat, aggression, and so for them there is often nothing between the formal handshake and the sexual caress. All that blank was filled by the Athshians with varied customs of touch. Caress, as a signal and reassurance, was as essential to them as it is to mother and child, or to lover and lover. But its significance was social. not only maternal and sexual. It was part of their language. It was therefore patterned, codified, yet infinitely modifiable. "They're always pawing each other," some of the colonists sneered, unable to see in these touch exchanges anything but their own eroticism, which, forced to concentrate itself exclusively on sex, and then repressed and frustrated, invades and poisons every sensual pleasure, every humane response. The victory of a blinded, furtive Cupid over the great brooding mother of all the seas and stars, all the leaves of trees, all the gestures of men. Venus Genetrix. So Selvar came forward with his hands held out, shook Lyubov's hand, Terran fashion, and then took both his arms with a stroking motion just above the elbow. He was not much more than half Lyubov's height, which made all gestures difficult and ungainly for both of them, but there was nothing uncertain or childlike in the touch of his small, thin-boned, green-furred hand on Lyubov's arms. It was a reassurance. Lyubov was very glad to get it. "Selvar, what luck to meet you here. I want very much to talk with you. I can't now, Lyubov." He spoke gently, but when he spoke, Lyubov's hope of an unaltered friendship vanished. Selvar had changed. He was changed radically, from the root. "Can I come back?" Lyubov said urgently. "Another day, and talk with you, Selvar. It is important to me." "I leave here today," Selvar said even more gently, but letting go of Lyubov's arms, and also looking away. He thus put himself literally out of touch. Civility required that Lyubov do the same, and let the conversation end. But then there would be no one to talk to. Old Tubab had not even looked at him. The town had turned its back on him. And this was Selvar, who had been his friend. "Selvar, this killing at Kelme Diva, maybe you think that lies between us, but it does not. Maybe it brings us closer together. And your people in the slave pens, they've all been set free, so that wrong no longer lies between us. And even if it does, it always did. All the same, I am the same man I was, Selvar." At first, the Athshian made no response. His strange face, the large, deep-set eyes, the strong features misshapen by scars and blurred by the short silken fur that followed and yet obscured all contours. This face turned from Lyubov, shut, obstinate. Then suddenly, he looked round as if against his own intent. "Lyubov, you shouldn't have come here. You should leave Central 2 nights from now. I don't know what you are. It would be better if I had never known you." And with that, he was off. A light walk like a long-legged cat, a green flicker among the dark oaks of Tuntar. Gone. Tubab followed slowly after him, still without a glance at Lyubov. A fine rain fell without sound on the oak leaves and on the narrow pathways to the lodge and the river. Only if you listened intently could you hear the rain, too multitudinous a music for one mind to grasp, a single, endless chord played on the entire forest.
"Selvar is a god," said old Sharar. "Come and see the fishing nets now." Lyubov declined. It would be impolite and impolitic to stay. Anyway, he had no heart to. He tried to tell himself that Selvar had not been rejecting him, Lyubov, but him as a Terran. It made no difference. It never does. He was always disagreeably surprised to find how vulnerable his feelings were, how much it hurt him to be hurt. This sort of adolescent sensitivity was shameful. He should have a tougher hide by now.
The little crone, her green fur all dusted and besilvered with raindrops, sighed with relief when he said goodbye. As he started the hopper, he had to grin at the sight of her, hop hobbling off into the trees as fast as she could go, like a little toad that has escaped a snake. Quality is an important matter, but so is quantity, relative size. The normal adult reaction to a very much smaller person may be arrogant, or protective, or patronizing, or affectionate, or bullying, but whatever it is, it's liable to be better fitted to a child than to an adult. Then, when the child-sized person was furry, a further response got called upon, which Lyubov had labeled the teddy bear reaction. Since the Athshians used caress so much, its manifestation was not inappropriate, but its motivation remained suspect. And finally, there was the inevitable freak reaction, the flinching away from what is human, but does not quite look so. But quite outside of all that was the fact that the Athshians, like Terrans, were simply funny-looking at times. Some of them did look like little toads, owls, caterpillars. Sharar was not the first little old lady who had struck Lyubov as looking funny from behind. And that's one trouble with the colony, he thought, as he lifted the hopper and Tuntar vanished beneath the oaks and the leafless orchards. We haven't got any old women. No old men, either. Except Dunna, and he's only about 60. But old women are different from everybody else. They say what they think. The Athshians are governed, insofar as they have government, by old women. Intellect to the men, politics to the women. And ethics to the interaction of both. That's their arrangement. It has charm, and it works for them. I wish the administration had sent out a couple of grannies along with all those nubile, fertile, high-breasted young women. Now that girl I had over the other night, she's really very nice, and nice in bed. She has a kind heart, but my God, it'll be 40 years before she'll say anything to a man. But all the time, beneath his thoughts concerning old women and young ones, the shock persisted, the intuition or recognition that would not let itself be recognized. He must think this out before he reported to HQ. Selver. What about Selver, then? Selver was certainly a key figure to Lyubov. Why? Because he knew him well, or because of some actual power in his personality, which Lyubov had never consciously appreciated? But he had appreciated it. He had picked Selver out very soon as an extraordinary person. Sam, he had been then, body servant for 3 officers sharing a prefab. Lyubov remembered Benson boasting what a good creature they'd got. They'd broke him in, right. Many Athshians, especially dreamers from the lodges, could not change their polycyclic sleep pattern to fit the Terran one. If they caught up with their normal sleep at night, that prevented them from catching up with the REM, or paradoxical sleep, whose 120-minute cycle ruled their life both day and night, and could not be fitted into the Terran workday. Once you have learned to do your dreaming wide awake, to balance your sanity, not on the razor's edge of reason, but on the double support, the fine balance of reason and dream, once you have learned that, you cannot unlearn it any more than you can unlearn to think. So many of the men became groggy, confused, withdrawn, even catatonic. Woman, bewildered and abased, behaved with the sullen listlessness of the newly enslaved. Male non-adepts and some of the younger dreamers did best. They adapted, working hard in the logging camps or becoming clever servants. Sam had been one of these, an efficient, characterless body servant, cook, laundry boy, butler, back soaper, and scapegoat for his 3 masters. He had learned how to be invisible. Lyubov borrowed him as an ethnological informant, and had, by some affinity of mind and nature, won Sam's trust at once. He found Sam the ideal informant, trained in his people's customs, perceptive of their significances, and quick to translate them, to make them intelligible to Lyubov, bridging the gap between two languages, two cultures, two species of the genus man. For 2 years, Lyubov had been traveling, studying, interviewing, observing, and had failed to get at the key that would let him into the Athshian mind. He didn't even know where the lock was. He had studied the Athshians' sleeping habits and found that they apparently had no sleeping habits. He had wired countless electrodes onto countless furry green skulls and failed to make any sense at all out of the familiar patterns, the spindles and jags, the alphas and deltas and thetas that appeared on the graph. It was Selver who had made him understand, at last, the Athshian significance of the word dream, which was also the word for root, and so hand him the key of the kingdom of the forest people. It was with Selver, as EEG subject, that he had first seen, with comprehension, the extraordinary impulse patterns of a brain entering a dream state, neither sleeping nor awake. A condition which related to Terran dreaming sleep as the Parthenon to a mud hut. The same thing, basically, but with the addition of complexity, quality, and control. Selver might have escaped. He stayed. First as a valet, then, through one of Lyubov's few useful perquisites as spesh, as scientific aide, still locked up nightly with all other creatures in the pen, the voluntary autochthonous labor personnel quarters. "I'll fly you up to Tuntar and work with you there," Lyubov had said, about the third time he talked with Selver. "For God's sake, why stay here?" "My wife Thiele is in the pen," Selver had said. Lyubov had tried to get her released, but she was in the HQ kitchen, and the sergeants who managed the kitchen gang resented any interference from brass and specials. Lyubov had to be very careful, lest they take out their resentment on the woman. She and Selver had both seemed willing to wait patiently until both could escape or be freed. Male and female creatures were strictly segregated in the pens. Why? No one seemed to know. And husband and wife rarely saw each other. Lyubov managed to arrange meetings for them in his hut, which he had to himself at the north end of town. It was when Thiele was returning to HQ from one such meeting that Davidson had seen her, and apparently had been struck by her frail, frightened grace. He had had her brought to his quarters that night, and had raped her. He had killed her in the act, perhaps. This had happened before, a result of the physical disparity. Or else, she had stopped living. Like some Terrans, the Athshians had the knack of the authentic death wish, and could cease to live. In either case, it was Davidson who had killed her. Such murders had occurred before. What had not occurred before was what Selver did, the second day after her death. Lyubov had got there only at the end. He could recall the sounds, himself running down Main Street in hot sunlight, the dust, the knot of men. The whole thing could have lasted only 5 minutes, a long time for a homicidal fight. But when Lyubov got there, Selver was blinded with blood, a sort of toy for Davidson to play with, and yet he had picked himself up and was coming back, not with berserk rage, but with intelligent despair. He kept coming back. It was Davidson who was scared into rage at last by that terrible persistence, knocking Selver down with a side blow. He had moved forward, lifting his booted foot to stamp on the skull. Even as he moved, Lyubov had broken into the circle. He stopped the fight. For whatever bloodthirst the 10 or 12 men watching had was more than appeased, and they backed Lyubov when he told Davidson, hands off. And thenceforth, he hated Davidson, and was hated by him, having come between the killer and his death. For if it's all the rest of us who are killed by the suicide, it's himself whom the murderer kills. Only he has to do it over and over and over. Lyubov had picked up Selver, a light weight in his arms. The mutilated face had pressed against his shirt so that the blood soaked through against his own skin. He had taken Selver to his own bungalow, splinted his broken wrist, done what he could for his face, kept him in his own bed. Night after night, tried to talk to him, to reach him in the desolation of his grief and shame. It was, of course, against regulations. Nobody mentioned the regulations to him. They did not have to. He knew he was forfeiting most of what favor he had ever had with the officers of the colony. He had been careful to keep on the right side of HQ, objecting only to extreme cases of brutality against the natives, using persuasion, not defiance, and conserving what shred of power and influence he had. He could not prevent the exploitation of the Athshians. It was much worse than his training had led him to expect, but he could do little about it here and now. His reports to the administration and to the Committee on Rights might, after the round trip of 54 years, have some effect. Terra might even decide that the open colony policy for Athshi was a bad mistake. Better 54 years late than never. If he lost the tolerance of his superiors here, they would censor or invalidate his reports, and there would be no hope at all. But he was too angry now to keep up his strategy. To hell with the others. If they labeled him Creechy Lover, his usefulness to the Athshians would be impaired. But he could not set a possible general good above Selver's imperative need. You can't save a people by selling your friend. Davidson, curiously infuriated by the minor injuries Selver had done him and by Lyubov's interference, had gone around saying he intended to finish off that rebel Creechy. He certainly would do so if he got the chance. Lyubov stayed with Selver night and day for 2 weeks, and then flew him out of Central and put him down in a West Coast town, Broter, where he had relatives. There was no penalty for aiding slaves to escape, since the Athshians were not slaves at all, except, in fact, they were voluntary autochthonous labor personnel. Lyubov was not even reprimanded, but the regular officers distrusted him totally, instead of partially, from then on. And even his colleagues in the special services, the exobiologist, the ag and forestry coordinators, the ecologists, variously let him know that he had been irrational, quixotic, or stupid. "Did you think you were coming on a picnic?" Gossa had demanded. "No, I didn't think it would be any bloody picnic," Lyubov answered, morose. "I can't see why any Hilfer voluntarily ties himself up to an open colony. You know the people you're studying are going to get plowed under, and probably wiped out. It's the way things are. It's human nature. And you must know you can't change that. Then why come and watch the process? Masochism?" "I don't know what human nature is. Maybe leaving descriptions of what we wipe out is part of human nature. Is it much pleasanter for an ecologist, really?" Gossa ignored this. "All right, then, write up your descriptions, but keep out of the carnage. A biologist studying a rat colony doesn't start reaching in and rescuing pet rats of his that get attacked, you know." At this, Lyubov had blown loose. He had taken too much. "No, of course not," he said. "A rat can be a pet, but not a friend." That had hurt poor old Gossa, who wanted to be a father figure to Lyubov, and it had done nobody any good. Yet it had been true, and the truth shall make you free. I like Selver, respect him, saved him, suffered with him, fear him. Selver is my friend. Selver is a god. So the little green crone had said, as if everybody knew it, as flatly as she might have said, so-and-so is a hunter.
Selver Sha'ab.
What did Sha'ab mean, though? Many words of the women's tongue, the everyday speech of the Athshians, came from the men's tongue that was the same in all communities, and these words often were not only two-syllabled, but two-sided. They were coins, obverse and reverse. Sha'ab meant God, or numinous entity, or powerful being. It also meant something quite different. But Lyubov could not remember what. By this stage in his thinking, he was home in his bungalow, and had only to look it up in the dictionary which he and Selver had compiled in 4 months of exhausting but harmonious work. Of course, Sha'ab, translator. It was almost too pat, too apposite. Were the two meanings connected? Often they were, yet not so often as to constitute a rule. If a god was a translator, what did he translate? Selver was indeed a gifted interpreter, but that gift had found expression only through the fortuity of a truly foreign language having been brought into his world. Was a Sha'ab one who translated the language of dream and philosophy, the men's tongue, into the everyday speech? But all dreamers could do that. Might he then be one who could translate into waking life the central experience of vision, one serving as a link between the two realities, considered by the Athshians as equal, the dream time and the world time, whose connections, though vital, are obscure? A link, one who could speak aloud the perceptions of the subconscious. To speak that tongue is to act, to do a new thing, to change or to be changed radically from the root, for the root is the dream, and the translator is the god. Selver had brought a new word into the language of his people. He had done a new deed. The word, the deed, murder. Only a god could lead so great a newcomer as death across the bridge between the worlds. But had he learned to kill his fellow men among his own dreams of outrage and bereavement, or from the undreamed-of actions of the strangers? Was he speaking his own language, or was he speaking Captain Davidson's? That which seemed to rise from the root of his own suffering and express his own changed being might in fact be an infection, a foreign plague, which would not make a new people of his race, but would destroy them. It was not in Raj Lyubov's nature to think, "What can I do?" Character and training disposed him not to interfere in other men's business. His job was to find out what they did, and his inclination was to let them go on doing it. He preferred to be enlightened rather than to enlighten, to seek facts rather than the truth. But even the most unmissionary soul, unless he pretend he had no emotions, is sometimes faced with a choice between commission and omission. What are they doing? Abruptly becomes, what are we doing? And then, what must I do? That he had reached such a point of choice now, he knew, and yet he did not know clearly why, nor what alternatives were offered him. He could do no more to improve the Athshians' chance of survival at the moment. Lepenin, Orr, and the Ansible had done more than he had hoped to see done in his lifetime. The administration on Terra was explicit in every Ansible communication, and Colonel Dunna, though under pressure from some of his staff and the logging bosses to ignore the directives, was carrying out orders. He was a loyal officer. And besides, the Shackleton would be coming back to observe and report on how orders were being carried out. Reports home meant something, now that this Ansible, this Machina ex Machina, functioned to prevent all the comfortable old colonial autonomy and make you answerable within your own lifetime for what you did. There was no more 54-year margin for error. Policy was no longer static. A decision by the League of Worlds might now lead overnight to the colonies being limited to one land, or forbidden to cut trees, or encouraged to kill natives. No telling. How the League worked and what sort of policies it was developing could not yet be guessed from the flat directives of the administration. Dunna was worried by these multiple-choice futures, but Lyubov enjoyed them. "In diversity is life, and where there's life, there's hope," was the general sum of his creed. A modest one, to be sure. The colonists were letting the Athshians alone, and they were letting the colonists alone. A healthy situation, and one not to be disturbed unnecessarily. The only thing likely to disturb it was fear. At the moment, the Athshians might be expected to be suspicious and still resentful, but not particularly afraid. As for the panic felt in Centralville at news of the Smith Camp massacre, nothing had happened to revive it. No Athshian anywhere had shown any violence since, and with the slaves gone, the Creechies all vanished back into their forests. There was no more constant irritation of xenophobia. The colonists were at last beginning to relax. If Lyubov reported that he had seen Selver at Tuntar, Dunna and the others would be alarmed. They might insist on trying to capture Selver and bring him in for trial. The colonial code forbade prosecution of a member of one planetary society under the laws of another, but the court-martial overrode such distinctions. They could try, convict, and shoot Selver. With Davidson brought back from New Java to give evidence, oh no, Lyubov thought, shoving the dictionary onto an overcrowded shelf. Oh no, he thought, and thought no more about it. So he made his choice, without even knowing he had made one. He turned in a brief report that next day. It said that Tuntar was going about its business as usual, and that he had not been turned away or threatened. It was a soothing report, and the most inaccurate one Lyubov ever wrote. It omitted everything of significance. The headwoman's non-appearance, Tubab's refusal to greet Lyubov, the large number of strangers in town, the young huntress's expression, Selver's presence. Of course, that last was an intentional omission, but otherwise the report was quite factual, he thought. He had merely omitted subjective impressions, as a scientist should. He had a severe migraine whilst writing the report, and a worse one after submitting it. He dreamed a lot that night, but could not remember his dreams in the morning. Late in the second night after his visit to Tuntar, he woke, and in the hysterical whooping of the alarm siren and the thudding of explosions he faced, at last, what he had refused. He was the only man in Centralville not taken by surprise. In that moment he knew what he was. A traitor. And yet even now it was not clear in his mind that this was an Athshian raid. It was the terror in the night. His own hut had been ignored, standing in its yard away from other houses. Perhaps the trees around it protected it, he thought as he hurried out. The center of town was all on fire. Even the stone cube of HQ burned from within like a broken kiln. The Ansible was in there, the precious link. There were fires also in the direction of the helicopter port and the field. Where had they got explosives? How had the fires got going all at once? All the buildings along both sides of Main Street, built of wood, were burning. The sound of the burning was terrible. Lyubov ran towards the fires. Water flooded the way. He thought at first it was from a fire hose, then realized the main from the river Menend was flooding uselessly over the ground, while the houses burned with that hideous, sucking roar. How had they done this? There were guards. There were always guards in jeeps at the field. Shots. Volleys. The yatter of a machine gun. All around Lyubov were small running figures, but he ran among them without giving them much thought. He was abreast of the hostel now, and saw a girl standing in the doorway, fire flickering at her back, and a clear escape before her. She did not move. He shouted at her, then ran across the yard to her, and wrested her hands free of the door jambs which she clung to in panic, pulling her away by force, saying gently, "Come on, honey, come on." She came then, but not quite soon enough. As they crossed the yard, the front of the upper story, blazing from within, fell slowly forward, pushed by the timbers of the collapsing roof. Shingles and beams shot out like shell fragments. A blazing beam end struck Lyubov and knocked him sprawling. He lay face down in the firelit lake of mud. He did not see a little green-furred huntress leap at the girl, drag her down backwards, and cut her throat. He did not see anything.